Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I am in the studio with someone who's going to represent the political left, Representative Brian King. Welcome, Brian.
Hello, this is Brian King on the left.
So nice to have you. Brian, I get to represent the political right with you today.
Oh,
how do you like that?
I like that. I think that's great.
We're missing the middle. Dan McKay is not in the studio, and so I'm going to do my best to be helpful here. And I thought, Brian, I thought we would start out with something that is getting a lot of attention. This week, the Utah Taxpayers Association had their annual meeting where they focus on taxes. You've been having hearings on tax reform.
Yeah.
I thought it would be good to just give our listeners a little bit of a feel for what's going on from the Democratic side in tax modernization, tax reform, and I'll try and fill it in from the right.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Give us a take.
Well, here's the thing. We had HB 441 that we did during the session. I give my hats off to and give credit to the Speaker and to the President and to the Governor for talking about a political, an issue that is important but doesn't have a lot of political upside to it.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's hard to talk about.
You have
this.
Winners and losers.
That's right. Well, and you know, we talk about how we have all these big budget surpluses, and the last thing people expect is, hey, we need to reform the way that we fund the Utah State budget, mm-hmm. and why we need to reform
yeah.
that. And people who are familiar with it understand what the problem is. What we've got is a problem with a shrinking proportion of our Utah State budget funded by sales tax, funded by the money that used to be the backbone of our Utah State budget. We've got a lot of income tax money, and it's been healthy in the last few years because of the economy in Utah being relatively good, and it's been growing and growing. And sales tax as a source of revenue has been growing too, but not as quickly as income tax. And the problem arises because all of our state income tax is constitutionally earmarked for use in general or rather in public and higher education, and it goes into what we call the education fund. So you've got this relatively healthy stream of revenue coming in, but it's all earmarked for public and higher education. And then you've got, relatively speaking, a slower growing source of revenue in the form of sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you find is us as legislators, I mean, the only constitutional job we have at the legislature each year, each session, is to put together a budget. You know
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
We can do anything. We can do
it's
a lot of
it's a pretty important responsibility,
yeah,
but
well,
it is your main one.
It's the main one. And it takes a lot of time. So what we're finding is more and more restrictions and inability to really fund a lot of other things that Utahns like, everything from public safety to transportation issues. Transportation issues are partially funded out of fuel taxes. But that's going down as a relative source of revenue in light of the fact that we've got electric vehicles and other sources of
fuel-efficient cars,
yeah.
whatever it might be.
So the challenge is, what are we going to do about this increasing restriction that we have on Utah's state budget? And that's what we're going around talking to people about.
Yeah, so you've outlined the problem really well. How does this break down along political lines? So if I were to just speak to it as a Republican, a conservative, you know, we're in a very strong economy right now.
Right.
Very strong. When your economy's strong is when you can actually go do things.
Right.
So if we were contracting, it would be very difficult to fix our tax structure.
Yes, it would.
And so when you say that we've got these legislators that you commend, the government you commend, they're seeing around a corner and trying to do something very difficult.
That's right. And I think Democrats give Republicans, I certainly give Republicans and the governor, Republicans in the legislature, namely Speaker and the President and Governor Herbert, credit for, as you say, trying to see around a corner and anticipate dealing
yeah.
with a problem.
So something's going to happen, and so you've outlined this for our listeners. You've got income tax, corporate and personal income tax in our state that's completely earmarked to higher and public education.
Right.
We're the only state in the nation that does that,
right? That's right. That's right.
Only
We're
state
also
in the nation. So it takes away all this flexibility,
yeah.
and it's part of the, you know, the problem explaining this to the public, because if you don't change that earmark, you don't have enough money to keep the rest of government going.
That's the argument. That's the concern. Now, the problem is also that we're 51st in the country, or 50th, depending on whether you're Idaho, we're ahead of Idaho or not, in spending through per capita, per pupil spending on K-12. So you can say, as I've heard one person say, that this is an important security blanket to have for public education, or this wag said to me, it's more like a security rag. It's really not a good security blanket in the sense that we haven't had much funding for education that has taken us to where we want to be.
You could argue it hasn't really
worked. Accomplished the job, yeah.
Well, and I don't remember the date. You'll know the date, but it wasn't several years ago that it could only be used for public education, and we actually took it to a vote of the people to make it also be used for higher. So we plugged the problem for a while.
That's right.
Gave some flexibility.
1996.
Brian, for the first time in my career, about a 3-decade-long experience as an economist in the state, the first time in my career, I see the income tax earmark at risk.
Yeah, well,
there's a pretty good chance right might take that away.
There is, here's the concern. I think obviously Democrats are more concerned about that because one of the things that is a traditionally Democratic leaning or supporting group of within the population are education officials, and that's one of the things that in District 28, which is the district that I represent, they feel strongly about clean air, public education. Those are the top two issues, right? And they should be, because our economic development and our quality of life in the future depends on having good quality public and higher education. So here's the question I have. I don't know where I'm going to end up on this. My knee-jerk reaction is to not want to remove that earmark simply because I think it provides some very important security in the form of a stable source of revenue for a critically important aspect of funding by the state government. But if you could give me some assurance that there is something to replace it that would be as stable in the future, or better yet, enhance funding levels in the future, I wouldn't necessarily.
Interesting. Yeah.
I would look at that. But
your goal is to fund public and higher education adequately.
Yeah.
One thing just to, I'll get you can ask me questions if you want here, but I think it's important for listeners to know that the issue here is not a tax increase.
Right.
Everything they're talking about is revenue neutral. It's just where that money comes from.
That's right. That's
and they
right.
know how to do the math to keep it so it's revenue neutral. Let's talk about a couple of the options that could be out there. Because you mentioned if you knew that public and higher education were going to be well-funded, you'd be okay letting go of the earmark. So you're hearing talk of a statewide property tax.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw these out in a bunch. We're hearing maybe something more on the motor fuel tax.
Right.
Potentially putting the full sales tax back on food. That would broaden the base because everyone buys food and they'd be paying that full tank.
Yeah.
As you go around the state and you have these hearings, what are you hearing might be part of the solution here?
Well, I'll tell you, we present a lot of solutions out there, and you've named some of them, but there are others. State lottery, sports betting.
I'm just hearing Dan, if they win the state lottery, and that's not going to happen, Brian.
Well, that's no, it isn't. I don't think it's likely, but I'll tell you what people say. Mm-hmm. They love the idea. I'm not a big fan of the state lottery, actually. Because it's remarkably regressive. But, you know, there's those kind of things. There are tourism as a tax that people are interested in because you can tailor it. If you do it well and smartly, you can do it in a way that people outside the state are the ones that bear the bigger burden on that.
Export that, yeah.
Yeah, so you can do that. You can talk about a carbon tax, one of the ways in which if you want to move in the direction of trying to get us toward renewables as opposed to non-renewables, we could do a carbon tax. And then we could use, in a revenue-neutral way, that could raise a lot of money, but if you want to make it revenue-neutral, what you could do is shift the income to assist those economies and those areas of the state that are going to struggle the most and be most dislocated by the transition from non-renewables to renewables.
I'm doing this in a little bit of a backwards manner, but I spoke at the Utah Taxpayers Association meeting yesterday.
Yeah.
I was on a panel with State Auditor John Dougal and also with the fiscal analyst Jonathan Ball. We went to great lengths to help people understand why this is happening.
Yeah, I think that's important.
See, I realize I'm doing this kind of out of order, but you know, remote sales is something out there. In other words, you know, buying things over the internet and whatnot, and because of some decisions, we're going to start collecting that revenue.
We will.
But we gave a lot of it away with the manufacturing exemption.
And our LFA people, our legislative fiscal analysts, are doing their best to try to come up with something that allows for us to estimate how much money we're going to be getting in the future because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but that's one thing that people say is, well, listen, we don't know how much money we're going to be bringing in the future because of online sales revenue that we haven't gotten in the past. So why don't we wait and see how that shakes out?
I'll offer two more. And then in our second segment, we're going to have Senator Todd Weiler join us. So that'll be nice to get a little bit of his flavor there.
Oh, do we have to? Natalie, come on. You and I were doing so well.
Two other items contributing to the imbalance. The aging population, Brian.
Yeah.
And this is something from the Gardner Policy Institute in demographics we know quite well. But, you know, right now we have about 1 in 10 or 65 and older in our state. Within the next 50 years, it'll go to 1 in 5.
Yeah. And I think that healthcare.
And that affects tax revenue because what senior people spend on is not taxed.
Absolutely.
Healthcare.
That's right.
You know,
well,
pensions.
It's going to call for more healthcare expenditures, too.
Yeah.
So, no, you're right. I mean, we've got to look at
planning.
The demographic trend. Although, I'd be interested in your outlook on this because you'd know, Natalie. How does Utah compare to other states? Aren't we less impacted by that geriatric move than a lot of other states?
Yeah, we are younger. Yeah, absolutely. The thing that's different in Utah that we're not used to is our birth rate now is also falling.
Yeah.
So we have the baby boom aging, and we're not replenishing it like we used to. And I'm telling you, it's like 47% of our population are millennials and Gen Xers in this state.
Yeah.
Get ready. It's time for them to take over.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we're going to have Senator Todd Weiler join me and Brian King. Keep listening. Thank you.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
This is Senator Todd Weiler on the right.
Representative Brian King on the left.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and so glad to have you join us, Todd.
Welcome. Oh, thanks. Sorry it's late.
We were having sort of a brainy discussion about tax reform, and we could keep doing that if you'd
No.
Should we go to politics a little bit more?
I'm sure Brian said everything there was to be said.
Yeah.
Let's go to Washington for just a little bit. I thought it was really interesting this week. I guess there was a kind of a bad interaction, I guess, between Democratic leadership and our president. The president said, I'm not going to work with you on, you know, infrastructure if you're just going to keep investigating me.
Well, but he did. I mean, but didn't Nancy Pelosi accuse him of a cover-up? I mean,
yeah. She did earlier in the day.
Yeah, she did. Correctly, she accused him of that.
This is the departure point. I loved Pelosi's quote where she said, you know, I pray for the president of the United States and I pray for the United States of America. She's gone religious on us.
Good for her.
Nancy Pelosi. I don't think of that from, you know, the San Francisco
congresswoman. Nancy Pelosi, you know, had all those years out of, you know, office of the speaker to think about this. She has performed remarkably well, I think, in this last 5 months.
Surprisingly so.
Yeah. But she's had some help because Representative Elon and Representative Alexandria, Ocasio-Cortez, mm-hmm. and Representative Maxine Waters, they all make Nancy Pelosi look reasonable, and like the adult in the room. And I'm not joking.
Brian, have you been surprised how her leadership has sort of been, you know, it's been the moment for her?
Yeah, no, I think she's done a great job.
She's prevailed over the president. She's keeping her caucus.
I think she's done a great job.
However.
But see, who's my question to you, Todd, is who is the moderate in the room with regard to Donald Trump? That's the problem. The Republicans really don't have a Nancy Pelosi equivalent on their side.
That's what's raised her. Is
that's
part
right.
of what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, she's filled
right.
a vacuum.
Yeah,
I think that's an interesting point.
If she gives in to demands and they hold impeachment hearings, I think Nancy Pelosi will single-handedly reelect Donald Trump.
Well, here's the problem, though. What do you do, Todd, when you have Donald Trump saying,
hold the impeachment
I am going
hearings.
To
do it because
no,
you're guaranteeing another 4 years of Republican.
But you're playing
in the
a
White
game
House.
Here. And my point is this. What would you have Democrats do in the face of absolute intransigent from Donald Trump?
Well,
and you know, if he's going to ignore the rule of law, yeah. doesn't he, to some extent, I mean, isn't the choice
have
the, the Democrats have to, do you roll over or not?
Have you checked off all your talking points yet, or do I need to give you a couple more seconds?
Todd, Brian, think of, let's localize
okay.
this to Utah.
All right.
Senator Romney.
Yeah.
He's playing an interesting role.
You know, he's kind of, and everybody criticized him, you know, the day before he was sworn in, but he was kind of setting the ground rules. He said, look, I'm not going to respond to every tweet. I'm going to engage when I want to engage. Mm-hmm. You know, don't call me up every time Trump tweets. And he's kind
it
of picking his battles.
It was quite a shot across the bow.
Yeah,
though.
He's kind of picking
no,
his battles.
No, he's been, I think from my perspective, he's been great. And I have, on Twitter, you've seen it if you paid attention, Todd, because I know you follow me diligently.
What's your handle?
Yeah. He has been remarkable from my perspective in having some backbone in a way that very few Republicans do. Now, I get very few people on the left giving him credit for having backbone at all because they want him to go further, right?
Yeah.
But how many Republicans even say what he said? There's the one Republican congressman who says, I think I gotta go. No, the Republican congressman
well
who
done,
says,
Todd.
That's, Todd,
clever.
You're terrible.
Clever.
You're terrible, Todd. The one Republican congressman who says he supports impeachment.
Yeah, the guy from Michigan. Nobody's ever heard of before.
Right, but is there any other senator that said what Mitt Romney said?
No.
And I think, look, in the face of the kind of conduct and behavior from Donald Trump that's unprecedented,
and he
from
voted
the Oval
against
Office.
He voted against one of Trump's appointments last week. Is the only Republican to vote against the appointment?
Judge.
Yeah, judge.
But it seems like Romney is in this a little bit of no man's land, and he's okay with it. And he's one of the only people that can do it.
He's Mitt freaking Romney.
True. Yeah.
I mean,
he's... Todd, I had that feeling. I was back in Washington maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I'm in one of the Senate office buildings, and I'm realizing that, you know, a lot of people could walk by because you'll see a senator and you're like, oh, that's who that is.
Yeah.
And you see famous people. But Romney is one of the people in that office building that everyone would know.
Yeah.
Okay. Whether you're a visitor.
Yeah, everyone.
Or,
he's got John McCain status. In some ways, he's the successor to John McCain.
Yeah.
A truth
teller who was willing to stand up to the president
really
and say, I don't care if you.
I'm grateful for him.
If you go outside of your home state, most Americans could probably name 5 or 10 senators. Mitt Romney will be on every one of those lists.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Let's come closer to home and talk about what happened up on Capitol Hill this week, where we had a little change in the backroom leadership. Greg Hartley, who had been the chief of staff for Speaker Hughes, was the Greg and Greg show.
Yeah, this is his fifth session. He just finished his fifth session as the chief of staff.
Announced that he was leaving.
And this is just on the House side. So why, I don't even know why Weiler's being asked about this.
I was looking at him.
I'm a big Jeff Hartley fan.
It's Greg Hartley.
Oh.
See? He shouldn't even be
asked. Jeff is his brother. I'm a big Greg Hartley fan, too.
But you have the Greg and Greg show, and you have the Hartley and Hartley show. I mean, but this is inside baseball. But what I think where it would mean something to listeners is that, to me, this was the signaling of Greg Hughes' gubernatorial campaign.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to that.
So Greg Hughes and Greg Hartley are tight.
Yeah.
And it appears that Cox has made his announcement, Spencer Cox, and that...
Well, and I think there's also another interesting angle to this that I've heard, just people on background saying it. I haven't heard this from Speaker Hughes, former Speaker Hughes at all, but that former Speaker Hughes is looking to maximize his ability to work with the possibility of John Huntsman coming back and running for governor, that those two could be working together in some fashion if Greg Hughes' own gubernatorial campaign doesn't pick up some steam and get traction.
Well, the scuttlebutt on the street.
I think, this is interesting. Are we breaking news here?
Scuttlebutt
coming from
Weiler.
Todd Weiler.
I think anybody who's paying attention knows that Greg Hughes had a very special relationship with John Huntsman Sr. And the scuttlebutt is because of, even though he's passed on, is that Hughes would not run if Huntsman Jr. came back to Utah to run. He would likely be, his LG.
Right.
And who wouldn't want to be Huntsman's LG? Because you know about 5 minutes after he wins the governorship, you're going to be governor.
I see no scenario where Greg Hughes would be a lieutenant governor.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely he would, because he knows that Huntsman wouldn't fill out his whole term.
That's the thought.
Do you want to be governor that badly? I mean, I'm not saying that it's a bad position, but I'm just saying he's been Speaker of the House. He's got a career and good things going on. I think he could have an appointment in Washington if he wanted it.
I'm not convinced that Greg Hughes can win as governor by himself, just like Gary Herbert could not have won as governor by himself. I mean,
Break it down a little bit for us, Todd. And then we'll ask Brian to give us from the D side.
Greg Hughes is a great guy, and I like him. I mean, if people that work with him
in leadership love his leadership.
If you are at a dinner party, you want to sit at Greg Hughes' table because he's funny, he's entertaining, doesn't take himself too seriously. He's a fighter, which can be good and not. But
seems a little inconsistent with the culture of the state, just throwing that out
there.
Yeah,
I mean, he grew up in Pittsburgh with a single mother, kind of fighting on the streets. But here, you look at John Huntsman Jr., you look at Gary Herbert, you look at even Norm Bangender or Mike Leavitt. These are kind of diplomats. Mm-hmm. Greg Hughes is more of, he's not a diplomat. He's more of a brawler, you know?
Okay, well, and you know, I got to say, Elaine Walker had a little bit of brawl in her.
Yeah, but
so,
she
you
was,
know, maybe we've had that
she
before.
She was mellowed by the time she became governor.
Okay, well, so. I'm just saying, you know, she was a fighter.
But also, she was never elected
governor.
But
break it down in a Cox, Hughes, who else are we going to see?
Oh, we're going to probably see a Greg Miller. We're definitely going to see Jeff Birmingham, who's a real estate developer out of Utah County. We may see a Rob Bishop or a Jason Chaffetz or both.
I think your list is so much more expansive than mine.
I mean, some of these people are going to drop out. Amy Winter Newton's already announced that she's running. Jeff Birmingham's already running. He hired a campaign manager 5 months ago. He's been showing up at every political event in the state, and nobody's ever heard of him, but a nice guy.
Yeah.
So, and maybe some of them are running for lieutenant governor.
Our frequent listeners will know that last week on the program, Senator Gene Davis, I asked him who on the Democratic side is going to step up
and
for governor.
Said Brian King.
He said, "Watch for Brian King."
I spit out my Diet Coke when I heard that.
You can announce it right here, or just put it down. But tell us about this from the Democratic perspective.
It's really critical that we have a great Democratic candidate for governor, as well as senator and Congress.
Well,
all those.
If we need a great one, it won't be you.
Well, look, I mean, here's the reality: it's hard to get high quality candidates to run for an office statewide when there is such a low likelihood of winning. I mean, honestly,
why put your family through it?
Right.
Why put your career through that?
Right.
Michael Weinholz spent $3 million, mostly of his own money,
right,
and got what 30%,
29%. Right, and Michael had his own problems, but he also had incredible upside in the sense that he was an enormously successful businessman and a great guy. I mean, I loved Michael, and and that's the reality, is that you have a lot of folks who could run credibly as Democrats. Natalie and I were talking earlier. Pat Jones, former state senator, remarkable woman.
Yeah.
She would be a great candidate.
Yeah.
She's a very principled person, too, that would, honor the office or
as a
candidate just by doing it.
Unlike Brian, she's a conservative Democrat.
Scott Howell, former state senator, good guy.
Who's run for governor and run for U.S. Senate before
and is an excellent choice.
I like Scott. I like Pat.
So there are people out there that
you could get
to run. So
those are the three names, King, Howell, and Jones.
Yeah, or maybe Ben McAdams.
Well, if McAdams wanted to come back and run for statewide office in Utah, he'd run for governor, I'm sure.
Well, we're going to keep hearing more and more about it. We need to go to gripes. And Todd, I don't know if you're ready for a gripe, but as you think about it, is there anything else you'd say on the gubernatorial race for people to watch for? In other words, like as you look at the summer, when are we going to start seeing some of the other candidates come out of the woodwork?
Oh, I think they're going to start, the serious contenders. Spencer Cox has moved up the agenda. I think he announced a little bit too early, but he's forcing the hands of others. Mm-hmm. But you're going to see people announcing, I think, through next November. I think you'll have probably—
All the way through.
Yeah. November of this year, you mean?
Well,
November is the election.
Yeah.
You're not
going to
find people announcing
it that soon?
October or September next year.
But just by announcing in September so you don't have to pay a campaign staff in the summer.
Yeah.
Don't want to peak too early. Todd, what have you got for a gripe for us?
My gripe is the rain, okay?
Okay.
We're
out of the drought.
Is that the best you can come up with?
We got the April showers. No, because I made a commitment. I've been riding my bike and taking public transport everywhere. I am sitting in wet pants right now because I have been rained on like nobody's business.
Do you have a fender on your bike? Because that really helps
with
the wet.
No, I need to go get one today. I was wishing
I had one. You have ones you can just clip on, so you don't have to have the ugly fender
all
the time.
I've been taking public transit to court. I rode my bike to the federal courthouse today for an appearance. It's kind of fun. I'm kind of the nerdy lawyer.
Yeah. Brian?
Why would you ride a bike when it's three blocks away?
It's quicker.
That's true.
Yeah.
You have any type of gripe?
I got a gripe. So, and this is something that I've spoken on a little bit. The LDS Church comes out last week and says, we're going to have these specialists that we're going to call to get people civically involved. Great. I love it. Let's have greater civic involvement. Here's the problem. Within the LDS Church culture, look, and I'm active LDS, former bishop, served an LDS mission, got to recommend right now. I know anybody who's grown up in the LDS Church culture in Utah, which excludes you, Weiler.
I'm LDS.
Didn't grow up in Utah. So anyway.
No, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
There you go. I thank you for that. So here's the reality. We're all taught the importance of being on the same page, being unified in terms of church doctrine, in terms of how we teach our Sunday school classes, in terms of, unity is key. So unless you're willing, at the time you call these specialists, to educate basically and in a very persuasive and effective way, the people who are called to recognize the importance of diversity in political viewpoints, this is going to concentrate the already significant heavy leaning of LDS Church members to be Republicans. That's the problem.
Brian, what do you think motivated this? I mean, some would say that this is Marty Stevens, a former House Speaker who's now in a communications role with the LDS Church, and just saying, you got to do this, just through his understanding of the political system and whatnot.
I think it's Prop 2.
Okay,
I think low voter turnout rates motivated it too.
And Prop 2.
Although our voter turnout rates last in 2018 were the 13th highest in the nation.
They're up, yeah.
But tell the listeners what you mean by Prop 2 inspired.
Well, I mean, because the church came out and said, we don't want medical marijuana. And then, like, nobody paid attention. And so then they're like, okay, well, we don't want Prop 2. We'll do a compromise.
Oh,
so, yeah, I think it's the fallout from Prop 2.
I'm with Brian on this in the sense that I really fear, it might be a little bit different angle, but I fear ecclesiastical overreach.
Oh, yeah.
So if all that happens is an organized religion helps you understand how to be a better, you know, citizen, that's great.
I think it's just going to teach people how to engage. They're not going to tell them what to engage on.
You're naive.
Where the overreach comes
naive.
Is
they
that
don't have to tell
where
them
the overreach comes is I don't think that a lot of people at the ecclesiastical level have the kind of judgment they should have
exactly.
to do that well.
Exactly. No.
They're not trained. They're going to go out
and they're going to think their job is to promote conservative thinking because that's what the church is a conservative political organization.
My gripe is not nearly as serious substantive as yours. I just have been bothered. My laptop got a little moist.
It's the rain. We're back to the rain.
Yeah, we're back to the rain.
I'm having to get
new computer set up, and I'm having to reset all these passwords, and I'm realizing how many passwords we carry in our brain.
Because
you're not supposed to have just one, right? Because then you're blown out of the water if someone, you know, cracks into your life. But I'm just, sometimes the digital world just kills me.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner, joined by Todd Weiler and Brian King. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.